Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sparity Again, the podcast where we take a classic book and we say, you know what, Mr. Book, give me everything you got. Show me what's inside. But we do it a bit nicer. You know, we like literature. I am here once again with Kalina.
Hello. I've never treated a book like that. Don't let Taylor fool you.
Don't trust Kalina either. And I'm also here today with Crystal.
Hello. I'm probably closer to Taylor on this one. Give me all your secrets.
You've beaten a book up before?
Yes.
Did you say beaten or eaten? Because they're very different.
I've definitely done both.
Nice.
Which book did you eat?
Ooh, which one did I eat? Pride and Prejudice, does that count? Can I eat that book up?
Oh man, I bet that tasted boring and was hard to eat.
I was gonna say, did we just open up Crystal's secret, like, you know, in her bedroom she's got a secret library with, you know, special books?
Eating books.
My most delectable.
Don't touch
books.
Them, them's my eating books. I need those.
They go on the top shelf.
Oh man. But today, you guys, today is such a special day. Today we have one special book. Today it's Frankenstein. So today's book we'll be going over is Frankenstein. And technically, the title is actually Frankenstein or the Modern Prometheus. And that's something I think they should bring back. I think there should be more titles that's like title or alternate title. I think that's kind of neat. This book was written in 1818. This is the oldest one we've done so far. Written by Mary Shelley, who a lot of people kind of christen as the progenitor of horror, the genre horror. Or some people actually say this is more of a science fiction book. So she's also kind of like, some people say, oh, she invented science fiction. I do enjoy this book. And we're going to go over the entire plot chapter by chapter, as we do at Sparity. And once again, we always recommend that you read the book yourself. Kalina, have you ever read Frankenstein?
No. I don't think I've read a lot of books.
Is that what you've learned from doing this podcast?
Yeah. He's like, these are classics. And I'm like, oh man, but I've learned a lot about the classics by reading this podcast. It's great for education.
Oh yeah. See, so, y'all should listen to it. Kalina's personal endorsement. Crystal, have you ever read this book?
You know, I was fairly certain that I had read this book in high school and was feeling pretty good about myself. And then I tried to remember anything about it and just came up with the title. So I'm going to go with no.
Well, that's great, because that means we can move into our next section in which both of you can regale us with the plot of Frankenstein. Kalina, if you had to guess what this actually goes on in this book, what do you think this book is about?
Okay, well, I know the story of Frankenstein. Well, we'll see. Well, let me. I might have just been shooting myself in the foot there. Is he green? I don't actually. Is he like the Hulk? So he's the Hulk with like little nails in his head, and he's got black hair. But he wears a trench coat, or like a coat instead of no shirt. And he's brought to life. Wait, okay. Frankenstein's not actually the name of the green guy. It's Frankenstein's monster. Frankenstein's the doctor that brings him back to life by stitching together people's body parts and then shoots a bunch of electricity into it by lightning on a stormy night. And then he terrorizes the town because he looks scary, but he's just misunderstood.
Not bad. Wow. All right. Crystal, is there anything you'd like to add, or is there anything you think is you're going to make a guess, a gamble of what happens in this book?
Oh man, Kalina covered so much more than I could have even tried to make up. staples. I'm adding staples. I think we have to guess the number of staples in Frankenstein's monster's head.
Does he have staples, or is it stitches?
Yes, I'm pretty sure there's a quote in this book that says, "And then I grabbed my stapler."
Wow. Really?
Success? That's an industrial stapler.
I'm totally kidding.
This one's a really interesting one because of all the books we've done so far, I remember, you know, telling people that we were going to do The Hound of the Baskervilles, the famous Sherlock Holmes story, and most people hadn't heard of that. In fact, no one I told had heard of that. 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. I feel like most people, maybe I'm overestimating, have heard of that, although they might have no idea what it's about. I certainly didn't. But you would be hard-pressed to find someone in Western civilization in general who hasn't heard of Frankenstein and have a rough idea of what it's about. So this is definitely the most famous story we've ever done. So we are going to go into the plot of Frankenstein, or the modern Prometheus. You guys ready to go?
Woo!
Let's do it.
Letter one of the letters. So this book has chapters that are just called chapter one, chapter two, but the first part actually isn't chapters. The first part is letters. They're literally letters, and it's called letter one, letter two, letter three, letter four. So the first letter starts with, quote, "To Mrs. Saville, England, St. Petersburg, December 11th, 17 blank," end quote. So I don't know why this is not the first classic book I've encountered that doesn't specify the year. It says 17 dash for whatever reason. But yeah, so basically we picked up that, you know, this is to somebody named Mrs. Saville who lives in England. And this letter is from St. Petersburg. And the person writing this letter starts off saying that they're on their dangerous adventure and they are doing better than their sister ever thought they were going to do. They're in St. Petersburg. It's really cold and they're really optimistic and they're really excited about the concept of the North Pole. Quote, "I may there discover the wondrous power which attracts the needle, and may regulate 1,000 celestial observations that require only this voyage to render their seeming eccentricities consistent forever. I shall satiate my ardent curiosity with the sight of a part of the world never before visited, and may tread a land never before imprinted by the foot of man." End quote. So that kind of talks about how he's excited to go on this adventure, and it gives you a sense of the type of language in this book. This book made me feel stupid because it has a lot of, like, the vocabulary of this book is 10 times mine, which is also why, you know, I recommend you should read it, because you can listen to me talk, but if you really want to get better at speaking, don't want to listen to me. Yeah. So this person talks about how their life's dream is to go on adventures. They spent their childhood reading in apparently their Uncle Thomas's library. He relates this to his sister because she knows what this person's talking about. They tried and failed to be a poet, then they inherited a fortune and went on this adventure, apparently. It says all this in this letter. For 6 years, they've been working as a sailor, and now they're on this adventure to the North Pole. They are going to leave St. Petersburg for Archangel, and once they're at Archangel, which is this town apparently in, like, northern Russia or something, I don't really know where it is, they're going to gather a crew and a ship, and they're going to go for their North Pole exposition and be the first person ever to go to the North Pole. Remember, this is 1818. The North Pole has never been reached by anybody. But yeah, the first successful North Pole expedition was in 1926.
That was going to be my next question.
Yeah, I had to look that up.
I swear you were going to say that was going to be my guess. 1926.
Nope, but yeah, so like it's 1818, this is a big thing. And then the letter ends with, quote, "Your affectionate brother, R. Walton." So at this point, we know it's some guy named R. Walton. Letter two is also to Mrs. Saville in England, and this one's from the town of Archangel. So apparently this Walton guy has got his ship hired, he's gathering a crew to go to the North Pole, and he's excited about it, but he talks a lot about what he's really missing is a friend. He really just wants someone to, he's very sentimental about this, about how he, just wants someone to, like, share in his joys and woes and blah, blah, blah. But he's still excited about the crew, and some of his crewmen are good men, and he's optimistic. And this letter ends with, quote, "Your affectionate brother, Robert Walton." So now we know his name is Robert.
So his name is not Frankenstein.
No, his name is Bobby.
Yeah, his is Bobby Walton. And this is not Frankenstein. Yep. So letter three is very short. And it basically says, hey, we're really far north. We're way beyond human civilization. We're on our way to the pole. It's getting kind of dangerous at this point, but he's still really enthusiastic and hopeful. And then letter four is the last one before chapter one, and it's much longer. It has multiple dates. So there's, like, I think it's supposed to represent that this guy wrote, like, a bundle of letters because he's so far in the middle of nowhere and then, like, sent them all somehow. he dates them too. So the August 5th one says they're completely surrounded by ice and they're actually in a lot of danger. These, you know, this is just wooden sailing ships, right, from 1818. So
I'm getting 20,000 leagues under the sea PTSD.
Right. You think he's going to end up under an iceberg?
He's going to get, yeah. Well, spoilies, if people haven't heard that episode.
Oh, yeah.
That we
yeah.
totally don't know that'll happen.
So they're surrounded by ice. There's this thick fog everywhere. There's nothing they can do for now. In the afternoon, the fog clears and there's nothing but ice in all directions. And the men were kind of hoping there was a way through the ocean. So they're all scared. They're all like groaning with fear and dismay. And as the fog clears, they're out beyond human civilization farther than basically anyone's ever been. And they see a sled being pulled by sled dogs in the distance about half a mile away.
All right, I'm invested. There's dogs.
How many dogs are there, Taylor? Important detail.
It doesn't say. That's it doesn't rude. Say. I'm sorry. So they see the sledge, quote, a being of which had the shape of a man, but apparently of gigantic stature, end quote. So there's this huge dude that's driving the sled miles and miles and miles away from civilization on like the barren ice in the middle of nowhere. And all of them, they're like the entire crew goes to the side of the ship to watch this guy because it's such a weird sight. And they watch him until he disappears into the distant north, way out into the distance. The ice breaks and they can sail again for a bit. And the next day, Robert Walton, the guy writing the letter, he wakes up and he goes up and the whole crew is gathered around the side of the ship again. And they're talking to somebody. And he looks over the edge and there's another sled with sled dogs drifting on an ice raft. So remember, they're sailing now, they're out of the ice. And so now there's just this chunk of ice with a guy and a sled dog and a sled on it. Because only one dog is left alive. Sorry, everybody. Apparently the rest of his dogs died.
I hate this book. What the heck? You can't just
drop that like it's some casual side content.
Gee, how many dogs are there, Taylor? Doesn't matter. Only one lives. That's what you should have said.
That's what the book says. I don't know what it is. Here, I should actually hold on. Yeah, it just says, quote, only one dog remained alive, end quote. That's the all it says about his dogs. Sorry, everybody. But anyways, there's this guy on an ice chunk floating there with his sled dogs. Apparently, he's on the brink of death as well. And the whole crew, he thinks they're like, oh, they must be like trying to fish him out of the water. They're actually talking to him, trying to persuade him to come on board. Because apparently he's resisting. Quote, on perceiving me, the stranger addressed me in English, although with a foreign accent. Before I come on board your vessel, said he, will you have the kindness to inform me whither you are bound? End quote. So he's drifting on an ice block miles and miles and miles away from civilization, close to the North Pole, and he won't get on until they tell him where they're going. And he says, well, we're on an expedition to the North Pole. And the man goes, oh, okay, cool. And he gets on.
I support him. That stranger danger. You can never be too careful.
So they bring him on board the ship and he looks awful. Obviously he's emaciated. He's frostbitten. He's near death. And as soon as they bring him on board, basically he says thank you and faints. So they wrap him in blankets. They bring him some food and they put him into the captain's cabin. And the letter goes on that he talks about this man they picked up over the course of several days. And he says, oh, he seems so kind and so intelligent. But he also seems very stressed and depressed, besides the fact that he almost died. Quote, I never saw a more interesting creature. His eyes have generally an expression of wildness and even madness. But there are moments when, if anyone performs an act of kindness towards him or does him any of the most trifling service, his whole countenance is lighted up, as if it were with a beam of benevolence and sweetness that I never saw equaled. But he is generally melancholy and despairing, and sometimes he gnashes his teeth, as if impatient of the weight of woes that oppresses him. End quote. So Robert Walton is pretty impressed with this guy, and he's also fascinated with him for several reasons. A few days go by, they're trying to let him recover, and Robert Walton is trying to keep his crew from being too curious, but the crew is too curious, and eventually the lieutenant says, well, what were you doing out here? And he has enough strength basically to have a conversation. And he says, well, I was chasing somebody. And the lieutenant asks, well, was the guy you were chasing traveling on a sledge? Which is, you know, a sled dog sled. And the man says, yes, he was. And he goes, well, we saw this big guy earlier. And the stranger they picked up just lights up. He's excited. Now he asks a lot of questions. And he asks questions about where the, quote, demon, end quote, went. And from this point on, the stranger has more energy. And he's always looking out over the ice. He's too weak to keep it up for too long. He constantly ends up being bedridden again. So he makes the men promise, if you ever see that sledge, you have to come get me immediately. And Robert says, quote, for my own part, I begin to love him as a brother, and his constant and deep grief fills me with sympathy and compassion. He must have been a noble creature in his better days, being even now in wreck so attractive and amiable. End quote. So, once again, we see that, male-to-male relationships were depicted a bit differently in old books, and it's kind of nice.
Good for them.
Good for them.
Yeah, as a brother. Just a lovely brother that I adore.
And they were roommates.
Purely amicable roommates.
Exactly. The next part is the August 13th. The next part of the letter. Robert is very impressed by this man. He's very happy with his new friend. He says, oh, I found this friend. What are the odds? He's writing to his sister. The stranger is now healthier. He's always on deck. He's always looking for this sledge out in the distance. And in other times where he's not looking, they have a lot of conversations and they talk a lot about the voyage. And the man is very encouraging. He's like, oh, Robert, you know, trust yourself and you're going to have a great adventure and blah, blah, blah. And Robert's very inspired by this. And during one of these conversations, Robert mentions how, yeah, you know, some men might die, but, you know, for the purposes of science and knowledge, it's totally worth it, right? And the man does not react well to this at all. As soon as he says this, he like covers his eyes with his hands and cries. Quote, at length he spoke in broken accents. Unhappy man, do you share my madness? Have you drunk also of the intoxicating draft? Hear me, let me reveal my tale, and you will dash the cup from your lips. End quote. So this is like a weird trigger for him. So after some hours, he composes himself and he changes the subject, and that's basically the end of that part of the letter.
All right, so the guy they picked up is Frankenstein, right? It has to be.
We'll see. August 19th, the stranger goes back to Walton, and he basically determines that he needs to tell him his story. He says, I know you're curious, and I've talked to you a lot. I've determined you're a pretty good guy, and maybe it'll make me feel better anyway, so I'm going to tell you my story. Quote, I had determined at one time that the memory of these evils should die with me, but you have won me to alter my determination. You seek for knowledge and wisdom, as I once did, and I ardently hope that the gratification of your wishes may not be a serpent to sting you, as mine has been. End quote. And then Walton says, I'm going to write down his whole story because I bet it's going to be awesome. And that's the end of all the letters.
Oh, I don't like this guy. He got all of his dogs killed. I haven't heard about whether the dog made it on the ship or not.
That's true.
Bad tidings.
Yeah, they don't mention if they brought the dog. Yeah. You know what? It was just headcanon. They brought the dog.
Thank you.
Yep. And he survives all the way to the end. And they name him Ruffles, and it's the best. Chapter 1. So this is the stranger telling his story to Robert Walton, and Robert Walton is writing it all down. Apparently this guy is from some great, venerable, noble family in Geneva, in Switzerland. And he talks about his family and his origins and how great his father is. Quote, as the circumstances of his marriage illustrate his character, I cannot refrain from relating them. End quote. So the next part he goes into is this big long story about how his dad met his mom and blah, blah, blah. And then the stranger talks about his childhood. Apparently he had a fantastic, happy, wonderful childhood.
That's impossible. Red flags. No one has fantastic, perfect childhood. He's making it all up.
Well, apparently there's only two ways to do it. Have a horrible childhood or a horrible adulthood, and we'll get around to that.
Ooh, zing.
Ooh. Take that, stranger man that definitely isn't Frankenstein. So, anyways. So his family travels all around Europe with their only child, which is this guy. His mom really wants a daughter, but they have great lives together. His parents are very generous and helpful. And in their generosity and their travels, they come across this poor family that has five kids and they can't provide for them. And the mother takes a really strong favor to one of them. And this one kind of has hints of racial discrimination. So watch out for this one. I mean, interpret it as you will. But quote, among these, there was one which attracted my mother far above all the rest. She appeared of a different stock. The four others were dark-eyed, hardy little vagrants. The child was thin and very fair. Her hair was the brightest living gold, and despite the poverty of her clothing, seemed to set a crown of distinction on her head. Her brow was clear and ample, her blue eyes cloudless, and her lips and the molding of her face so expressive of sensibility and sweetness that none could behold her without looking on her as of a distinct species, a being heaven-sent, and bearing a celestial stamp in all her features. End quote. So there's like all these poor Italian kids, but then there's this blonde-haired, blue-eyed one, and oh my god! So, yeah, but I don't know. Apparently she's really pretty, and she's a sweet little kid, but take what you will.
I mean, there's only one way the angels look, and that sounds about right. I mean, is there anything to argue with there?
Yeah, yeah, right. So here's another trope that comes up all the time in old books that I've seen. This kid isn't actually the poor woman's child. She's actually the daughter of a nobleman, and it just fell out into, you know, chance that she ended up here. Because, of course, any significant person in any ancient story or any old story has to be noble, right? Like, peasants just don't make stories. But I'm going to start a class war here in this podcast. Viva la revolution! I want a book about a peasant, damn it. So, anyways, it's not really her kid, and her mother died in childbirth. Her father was this Italian nobleman who fell out of grace, got himself killed. So this person's parents adopt the girl as their own. Quote, the result was that Elizabeth Lavenza became the inmate of my parents' house, my more than sister, the beautiful and adored companion of all my occupations and my pleasures. End quote.
This is getting creepy real fast.
Yeah. I can see why she's the, mother of horror.
So they call each other cousin, this stranger and this woman, but they're the best of friends. And he also calls her his more than sister. Right. Yeah. And that relationship is a little strange, but anyway, that's the end of that chapter.
All right. So after that chapter, do you think Frankenstein has more mommy issues or daddy issues?
I don't know who you're talking about. Who's Frankenstein? I don't know who you're talking about. Chapter 2. The stranger and Elizabeth have a wonderful, beautiful, happy childhood together in Geneva. And it's utterly beautiful because it's, you know, the Alps and Switzerland, and it's wonderful. And they're like a noble family. So, of course, they have their house, and they have another house in a place called Bellerive next to a lake that's also beautiful. She loves poetry and nature and is just the kindest sweetheart you've ever met. And he loves discovery and knowledge and that sort of stuff. So later on, his parents have another boy child who's 7 years younger than this stranger. And the man's best friend becomes a guy named Henry Clerval. Henry Clerval is the son of a merchant. He's this adventurous guy who's very kind, and he loves chivalry and heroism, and he's very charismatic. He's just the best of friends, and he's just the best guy ever. So everyone in his life is just great. Quote, no human being could have passed a happier childhood than myself. My parents were possessed by the very spirit of kindness and indulgence. End quote. So yeah, everything's wonderful way back when.
All right, you're selling me on this. Sounds pretty fun.
So he has this really strong desire to learn. He's really curious and all this stuff. And his friend Clerval dreams of heroics. And Elizabeth is just perfect and is kind to everyone, and everyone loves her. And about Elizabeth, quote, her smile, her soft voice, the sweet glance of her celestial eyes were ever there to bless and animate us. She was the living spirit of love to soften and attract, end quote. I include some of these quotes because, like, just to get a sense of the narrative tone, like, he is unendingly praising and Elizabeth and talking about how beautiful she is and how perfect she is and how much fun Clerval is and all this stuff.
She's gonna die, isn't she?
I don't know.
There's too much, like, she's so perfect. She's an angel. She's nothing but sweet. She's gonna die.
So when he's 13 years old, he discovers some books by a person named Cornelius Agrippa. This was a real person who's like a scholar and like one of the early like attempts at science people, I guess, from around like the time of the Renaissance. He's a scholar. He's also an occult writer, as he's described. So he has some like really weird ideas, but he absolutely loves it. This is like his first soiree into knowledge outside of his little world, and he's enamored. And he shows the book to his dad, and his dad says, oh, don't read that guy. Agrippa's a quack. Don't read him. And because he says this, he thinks it's even better, and he wants to find more books like this. So he finds similar works by other people like this, one guy named Paracelsus and one guy named Albertus Magnus. These are also real people that have made a lot of scientific claims that are generally not true, I guess. Quote, under the guidance of my new preceptors, I entered with the greatest diligence into the search of the philosopher's stone and the elixir of life, but the latter soon obtained my undivided attention. Wealth was an inferior object, but what glory would attend the discovery if I could banish disease from the human frame and render man invulnerable to any but a violent death? End quote.
Darn, he was almost Harry Potter. If he went with the former.
Right?
Look at how his... fate has changed.
So when he turns 15, he has an event in which a tree gets hit by lightning outside his house and it just explodes into like shreds. And he's absolutely in awe of the power of the lightning. So basically this display of power has kind of changed his view on science. And he kind of, it's funny because he doesn't really think, oh, now I really want to study science. He basically thinks, from what I've read so far, and then the power of this lightning, he realizes that man has no chance of ever fully understanding science because it's just too powerful. It's just too much. The ways of the universe are so much that man will never fully understand it. So he kind of gives up on science and he turns to math instead. And that's it. That's the end of the chapter. Chapter 3. The stranger is 17 years old at this point, and he says he was going to go to the university at Ingolstadt. Before he leaves,
did you just Elizabeth, make that up? Is that a real university?
Ingolstadt's a real town? I don't think I actually verified this. 1 second. Stand by. Ingolstadt. Yeah, it's in Germany. It's real. Yep. Before he leaves for university, Elizabeth catches scarlet fever. Which, you know, this is 1818. If you catch any disease with a name, you're probably going to die. Yeah. Get your vaccines, people.
Wait, is it... are things just named after colors? Like Black Plague and Scarlet Fever? Is this a theme?
Yeah, usually they're named after, like, the color that people turn or, like, the color of, like, wounds and stuff that you get, right?
Ah.
Yeah. So, they're worried about Elizabeth. And everyone says you need to stay away from her because they're at least somewhat aware of the idea of contagions. But their mother just can't help it. She decides she's going to go to Elizabeth and tend to her. Elizabeth pulls through. But then their mom catches it. And their mom does not.
Oh, yeah. No.
So here's a quote from the stranger's mom on her deathbed. Quote. She joined the hands of Elizabeth and myself. My children, she said, my firmest hopes of future happiness were placed on the prospect of your union. This expectation will now be the consolation of your father. Elizabeth, my love, you must supply my place to my younger children. End quote. So apparently her mom wants nothing more than for this stranger and Elizabeth to get married. Even though they're basically like, I don't know. But yeah, I guess they're not technically related. So, okay.
I have a question.
Sure.
This is kind of a morbid question. Did Elizabeth live because the mom tended to her, or was it just a pointless death? Did she not need to be there and she just died?
Ooh, that's a good question for drama's sake. But no, it actually doesn't say anything about like, oh, if only she hadn't or anything like that.
Ah, okay.
So yeah, there's none of that aspect to it. So his mother dies. Everyone in the family is sad. He thinks it's not right to leave for university immediately without grieving, so they hang out for a few weeks, and Elizabeth is very sad, and he has to console her. But he's still going to Ingolstadt. He's still going to the university. And Elizabeth is also, you know, this golden sweetheart who, even though she's super sad, she makes everyone else happy, and it's all great. So his friend Clerval wants to go to university with the stranger, and he tries to convince his merchant father, but his merchant father says, university is dumb, you can't go. And Clerval can't go, so he's upset. And they spend their last evening together before the stranger leaves for Ingolstadt. They have trouble saying goodbye, and then finally he leaves, and he's in a carriage, and he's on his way to Ingolstadt. So eventually, he arrives at Ingolstadt. He's there now. Quote, the next morning, I delivered my letters of introduction and paid a visit to some of the principal professors. Chance, or rather the evil influence, the angel of destruction, which asserted omnipotent sway over me from the moment I turned my reluctant steps from my father's door, led me first to Monsieur Crempy, professor of natural philosophy, end quote. So I put that in just to, like, highlight the fact that as this guy, this stranger, is telling his story, he'll often end sentences or paragraphs with, that was a good time. If only I had known how terrible everything was about to be. Like, he constantly does this. So the first professor he meets is Monsieur Crempy, who's like this rude, short, ugly guy. He doesn't like him. And Crempy asks, what's your education so far? And the stranger says, well, I used to read all these alchemists and these guys who thought themselves scientists. And Professor Crempy says, have you really spent your time studying such nonsense? And the stranger is a little bit defensive and says, yeah, I have. And Professor Crempy says, oh, well, that's pathetic and sad. And how sad that no one corrected you. Here, let me give you a reading list. So the stranger is not feeling good about university at this point. Quote, I had a contempt for the uses of modern natural philosophy. It was very different when the masters of the science sought immortality and power. Such views, although futile, were grand. But now the scene was changed. I was required to exchange chimeras of boundless grandeur for realities of little worth. End quote. So basically, he doesn't really like science because, one, he thinks it's pointless. He doesn't think there's any chance of humanity understanding the cool stuff. And two, when he was studying, like, the philosophers way back when, they were talking about, like, finding the elixir of life and stuff like that. And now scientists are like, I wonder if I can discover the properties of tin. And that, like, really bores him. He doesn't care.
Man, fast forward 200 years and we still feel the same way, buddy.
Right? Oh man, yeah, that one strikes close to home, man. And then he meets Monsieur Waldman, the other professor. This guy teaches chemistry. He's a middle-aged guy, he's very kind, he's a good teacher, and the stranger likes him a lot. And Monsieur Waldman talks about how real-world science, sure, it can seem boring, but if you really study it, it can unlock the powers of the universe. And the stranger never thought of it this way, and he's completely enamored.
Well, I mean, that's because chemistry is just what alchemy renamed, right? So.
Basically. Quote, so much has been done, exclaimed the soul of Frankenstein. More, far more will I achieve, treading in the steps already marked. I will pioneer a new way, explore unknown powers, and unfold to the world the deepest mysteries of creation. End quote. So now we know that Frankenstein is this guy's name. And he's also endeavored to discover science no one else has ever discovered. Frankenstein later goes to see this professor again that he really likes, Mr. Waldman, and he tells him about all the alchemists that he liked before, and Waldman is much kinder about it, and so Frankenstein is just smitten. He thinks that this is the best professor ever, and that chemistry is what he's going to study. Chemistry is for him. And that's the end of the chapter. Chapter 4. So Frankenstein is absolutely obsessed with chemistry now. Monsieur Waldman is his good friend. It says M. Waldman. This is a lot like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, where everyone is annotated by like M. Waldman and M. Crempe, which they all speak French because they're from Switzerland. So I assume it's Monsieur, but it could be Mr. I don't know.
Or Miss.
Yeah, way to assume gender.
They literally say the guy is middle-aged and balding.
Yeah, well, he could identify differently. This is 1818.
Yeah, yeah.
They had a lot of wigs.
So 2 years go by at the university, And Frankenstein is blowing the doors off the university. He's super smart, easily the top student, even to the point that he like invents and improves some chemical instruments and some chemical experiments that even the staff are stunned. And he's so focused in all his studies that he doesn't even visit home once the entire time. He feels he's kind of outgrown the university because he's advanced so quickly. And then he starts to think, all right, maybe I could do something that's beyond what anyone else could do. He starts to think about how life works, and he thinks, how are things actually alive? And in order to do this, he starts studying death. Quote, "To examine the causes of life, we must first have recourse to death. I became acquainted with the science of anatomy, but this was not sufficient. I must also observe the natural decay and corruption of the human body. I saw how the fine form of man was degraded and wasted. I beheld the corruption of death succeed to the blooming cheek of life. I saw how the worm inherited the wonders of the eye and brain." End quote. So he started to go a little off the deep end with studying death and stuff. And he gets so deep into it that he kind of enters the state of flow where he starts to perceive the world in like a different way. Eventually in the flow of these studies, he has like this major revelation. Quote, "I examined the change from life to death and death to life, until from the midst of this darkness a sudden light broke in upon me, a light so brilliant and wondrous, yet so simple, that while I became dizzy with the immensity of the prospect which it illustrated, I was surprised that among so many men of genius who had directed their inquiries towards the same science, that I alone should be reserved to discover so astonishing a secret." End quote. So he has like this revelation that he realizes the complete nature of the transition between life and death and death and life. And he's excited and he's awestruck and he doesn't really know what to do with this information. And in the midst of this, Frankenstein turns to Walton, the guy on the ship, remember, we're on a ship, and that he's telling the story to. And he says, "Look, Walton, I can tell that you're curious, because of course he is, but I'm not going to tell you what this secret is," right? Quote, "I will not lead you on, unguarded and ardent as I then was, to your destruction and infallible misery," end quote. So that's a little like neat aside that he throws out in the little story. He's like, yeah, I know what you're thinking, but no, I'm not going to tell you.
He's not going to tell him how to cheat death. Jeez, what a selfish guy.
I was just thinking that. And he's going to write this all down. So it's like, you know, you can have everything except like parts of my life. So it's like, oh, so you're omitting things. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, fine.
So Frankenstein goes back to his story and he wonders what he's going to do with this information. And he thinks about, well, maybe I could try it like with a small creature, like with a mouse or something. But he's so excited and he's so confident in his abilities. He's like, nope, I'm going to go straight for the gold. I'm going to create man. And he knows it's going to be hard, but he just has to. And he also figures that, you know, since small things and small veins and small arteries and small bones are really hard to work with, I'm going to make this guy huge. Quote, "about 8 feet in height and proportionably large," end quote. So he's going to make this giant man. He starts work on this and he's completely in flow state. He's absolutely consumed by motivation. He's going to be the first person to ever create life. So he hasn't gotten any sun. He's basically not eating as much and he's putting in super long hours. He's obsessed with this project. He gets thin. He gets pale. But he's absolutely determined. And on the work that he's doing, quote, "Who shall conceive the horrors of my secret toil as I dabbled among the unhallowed damps of the grave or tortured the living animal to animate the lifeless clay? My limbs now tremble and my eyes swim with the remembrance, but then a resistless and almost frantic impulse urged me forward. I seem to have lost all soul or sensation but for this one pursuit," end quote. And then later he says, quote, "I collected bones from charnel houses and disturbed with profane fingers the tremendous secrets of the human frame in a solitary chamber, or rather cell, at the top of the house and separated from all the other apartments by a gallery and staircase. I kept my workshop of filthy creation," end quote.
Dang. This is getting so creepy.
He knows he's doing things that's, you know, questionable to society, but he's still going to continue to do them.
He knows he's a naughty boy.
It's super hyper-focused. Gosh,
what was that from? Was that from Courage the Cowardly Dog, where the guy goes, "and then I did something naughty"?
Yeah, that's Freaky Fred.
Yeah. So yeah, he's he won't go into the details because at this point the person telling this, the Frankenstein telling this story, doesn't want to, because in a way he's kind of ashamed and he realizes now how terrible it was, but at the time he's doing some dark shit. He spends almost 2 years completely obsessed with this project. He hasn't visited home. He hasn't even written to them. And his obsession is starting to affect his mental health as well. Quote, "Every night I was oppressed by a slow fever, and I became nervous to a most painful degree. The fall of a leaf startled me, and I shunned my fellow creatures as if I had become guilty of a crime. Sometimes I grew alarmed at the wreck I perceived that I had become." End quote. But at this point, he's almost done. And that's the end of the chapter.
Dun, dun, dun!
Chapter 5. So this is the big one, you guys. So it's November now. It's late at night, and the experiment is ready to go. And this is something I really want to point out, because this is obviously an iconic moment in literary history. And also, I think it's interesting how, because everyone knows the pop culture of Frankenstein. In fact, Kalina, you mentioned it earlier. You know, everyone knows how it goes, where he's in like the tower and he pulls the lever and the lightning strikes and the electricity is all around and he yells, "It's alive," right? Like everyone, a lot of people know that, right? But here's the quote from the book. Quote, "I collected the instruments of life around me that I might infuse a spark of being into the lifeless thing that lay at my feet." End quote. That's all it says about how he brings this guy back to life. So it actually, he has chemical instruments and he's a student of chemistry. And it doesn't mention anything about electricity other than the lightning strike of the tree that inspired him early in the book. And the fact that he uses the word spark here is basically the only thing. There's no electricity involved besides those hints, which I thought was really interesting. Because again, he's not about to tell Robert Walton or anybody how he actually does this.
Okay, but that's like way too coincidental. Like there was the lightning strike when I was a kid to a tree and I watched it basically explode that tree. Wow, lightning's powerful. I bet I could use that, you know? Seems too coincidental.
Yeah.
Must have used it.
Yeah.
The creative liberty taken in movies seems very warranted. And you know Walton is thinking the same thing. He's like, he obviously shocked the shit out of that body.
Yeah. He puts a little note at the bottom. He's like, he used electricity. I know it. So he does whatever he does to bring this thing back to life. And it starts to wake up. Quote, "By the glimmer of the half-extinguished light, I saw the dull yellow eye of the creature open. It breathed hard, and a convulsive motion agitated its limbs." End quote. It's at this moment that realization hits Frankenstein like a truck. As soon as this thing opens its eye and as soon as it starts moving, he is utterly horrified. And the reality of what he's been doing and what he just did is too much for him. It's horrible. Quote, "His limbs were in proportion, and I had selected his features as beautiful." Beautiful? Great God! His yellow skin scarcely covered the work of muscles and arteries beneath. His hair was of a lustrous black and flowing, his teeth of a pearly whiteness. But these luxuriances only formed a more horrid contrast with his watery eyes. End quote. So Frankenstein purposely chose big, beautiful, you know, he makes this guy huge. He makes him like physically perfect as he could. He makes him beautiful. But the second it starts to move is when it's just hideously horrible to him.
You guys, you know that like social thing where it's like, if something looks like it's a robot and it looks like a human, the more human it looks like, the more you freak out because you're like, there's something off about it.
The uncanny valley. Yeah.
Is that what it's called? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like that. Also, he's yellow. He's not green.
He is yellow. Yeah. His skin is like a dead flesh yellow color.
Because yellow fever?
Oh, all right.
Quote, "I had gazed on him while unfinished. He was ugly then, but when those muscles and joints were rendered capable of motion, it became a thing such as even Dante could not have conceived." End quote.
Wait, so, I'm sorry. Did we pass the stapler part?
No stapler. Everybody, no stapler.
Damn it, Taylor.
In fact, interesting note, one, his skin is not green. It's explicitly said to be yellow. Two, there's no mention of metal studs coming out of his neck, which you often see in depictions of Frankenstein. And three, he's supposed to be hideous to look upon and dead, but also kind of good looking, I guess. So, yeah.
Okay, so as you were going through that, all I could think about is, like, when you see someone from across the room, and you're like, ooh, look at that snack, and, like, you go walk up to them, and you start talking, and then they start talking, and you're like, oh, never mind, never mind. Stop talking, you're walking away now.
So Crystal's thing would be more like, hey, oh my god, I did it, woo! He stands up and goes, hey, how's it going? And you're like,
Yeah, it would be when he starts talking. This is all fine. He can open his roomy eyes as long as...
I'm looking for a great trad wife. You think you could do it? Kill it with fire!
It was a mistake. This was all a mistake.
So this moment happens. Frankenstein brings this thing back to life, and he's hit with realization. He's so revolted and terrified, he just leaves it where it is and runs back to his room. And then he just lays in his bed, trying to sort his thoughts and deal with what he's done and think about what he's done. Eventually, he falls asleep. And he has a nightmare that has to do with, like, death and the death of his family and that sort of stuff. And he wakes up, and there's the creature. The thing he created, the monster. And it's holding the bed curtain aside and it's staring at him. It's just standing there, 8 feet tall, staring at him while he sleeps. Quote, his jaws opened and he muttered some inarticulate sounds while a grin wrinkled his cheeks. He might have spoken, but I did not hear. One hand was stretched out, seemingly to detain me, but I escaped and rushed downstairs. End quote. So his nerves are shot. He is absolutely terrified, horrified, and he's out in the courtyard of this apartment complex at the university where he's staying, and he doesn't know what to do. He's just pacing around outside and trying to deal with his thoughts. He can't believe how horrifying this all is.
Okay, random question. So Mary Shelley, does she have kids, and did she already have kids when she wrote this book?
One second.
So I'm trying to envision, like... the motive or the inspiration for having him just like stand over your bed, you know? And I feel like parents are intimately aware of that. That's like, oh, look at my sweet child. It's so creepy.
Oh, this went a different way than I thought. I thought Crystal was going to say is this what she read her kids as a bedtime story?
You want to read the book that mommy wrote, sweetie?
I want to read the book.
And then he took his hand and attached it to the other arm.
Like, yes.
But yeah, Mary Shelley had 4 kids, actually.
Ooh.
It says. So, yeah. So the morning comes, and this courtyard has it's like a gated courtyard. They open the gates, and he runs out into the streets. He has no direction. He's just running, walking fast and running. He doesn't know where to go. He just needs to go. And he eventually ends up at an inn where there's some carriages from out of town arriving. And his friend, Henry Clerval, steps out of one of the carriages just by chance. And Frankenstein can't believe it. And they see each other and they're so happy to see each other. Clerval's so happy to see Frankenstein. Frankenstein's so happy to see him. And Henry says, yeah, I convinced my dad to let me go to university, finally. And so now he's here in Ingolstadt so he can go to school. He says everyone back home is happy and fine, but they're worried about Frankenstein because he hasn't wrote and he hasn't visited in ages. And then Henry looks at him and goes, holy shit, you're so thin and you look insane. Are you okay? And Frankenstein kind of says, oh yeah, sure, I guess. Here, come back with me and we'll go hang out. And they go back to the apartment at the college where Frankenstein lives. And Frankenstein is so swept away with, you know, oh, Clerval's here, everything's going to be okay, that they make it back to the door and he realizes, oh shit, the monster's probably still in there. He doesn't want to see it himself because he doesn't think his nerves can take it. And he absolutely thinks Henry can't see it because then he's going to have to explain himself. So he says, wait here. And he runs upstairs. And he's like bashing doors open and fearfully looking around, but he doesn't find it. It's not there. So he's relieved and he goes back down. He gets Clerval and they go inside.
And he's relieved. He just lost an 8-foot man.
Right? This is what I thought too.
He's like yeah. Ooh, good thing he's not in there. Like, he doesn't think like, oh my god, where did he go?
Yeah, right? No, he's very much like, oh, woo, it's gone. Everything's fine.
Like, out of sight, out of mind.
Oh, man.
Oh, man. So they go in and they have breakfast, and he's feeling really anxious, and his nerves are shot to the point that he's, like, manic, right? Like, he's so happy that Clearville's here, and he's so happy that the monster is gone, but also, like, in the back of his mind, he's probably thinking, like, it's still out there. So he's, like, losing his mind, and Clearville, like, notices this, and his friend Clearville says, like, are you okay? Quote, "My dear Victor," cried he, "what, for God's sake, is the matter?" "Do not ask me," cried I, putting my hands before my eyes, for I thought I saw the dreaded specter glide into the room. "He can tell! Oh, save me, save me!" I imagined that the monster seized me. I struggled furiously and fell down in a fit. End quote. Hopefully I can use that quote because my dog was scratching. But yeah, so Frankenstein just at this point collapses out of basically insanity. Like, he's so shot, he's so physically worn that this last moment of manic happiness combined with terrible fear has just brought him down, and he becomes bedridden for several months. And Henry Clerval stays there and cares for him. Occasionally, as he's laying there, or Henry's caring for him, he goes into insane rants about, like, oh, what have I done? And this monster is a horrible thing. And Henry hears these, and he's like, well, I guess he's just, you know, delusional because, you know, he's having a really hard time mentally. But he notices that these delusional rants are consistent, and they tend to point back to the same points, and he starts to wonder about some of this. All winter passes like this, with Henry caring for Frankenstein and Frankenstein basically bedridden because he's shot.
Oh my god, he's lost the monster for like an entire winter?
Yes.
Oh my god.
Yes, he has. Yes.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Like, how does nobody seen this monster in the middle of, what, Germany? I guess just no one's seen it. I feel like this monster should be a similar, like, story and lore to the 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, where it's like, oh, there's this monster in the ocean. It's like, oh, there's this monster in our tiny town.
Yeah, right? Like, but nope, he just basically, it's gone, and he tries not to think about it, and yeah.
The real monster is guilt, because if he didn't have such a, like, guilty conscience, he could be like, oh my god, a monster! Whoa, what is that? And, you know, and feign ignorance.
That's the philosophical part of this.
That's the real killer.
So, Frankenstein stays like this all winter. The spring comes, and Frankenstein is getting better now. And he thanks Clearville profusely. He says, oh, my friend, without you, I don't know what I would have done. And he says, is there anything I can do for him? And Clearville says, yeah, there's one thing I'd like to discuss. And Frankenstein almost has a mental breakdown again, because he's like, oh, no, I know what he's going to ask. But Clearville just says, yeah, there's one thing I want to discuss. You need to write home, because they're worried about you. And also, there's a letter waiting for you. And that's the end of the chapter. Chapter 6. So basically, the first half of this chapter is this letter. It's from Elizabeth. And it says, hey, I really want you to write. I'm really worried about you. Henry has been writing letters along the way while he's been taking care of you. But he's been really close to the chest. He's been really reserved. He hasn't told us all the details. So I'm really worried about you. And she talks about her family. Apparently their younger brother, Ernest, is 16 now. And she tells this story about how they have this servant girl, named Justine Moritz, that had an abusive mother, but they thought she was just great. And they took her into their own family, and she's wonderful and kind. And she's Elizabeth's favorite. She's just this fantastic person. Everybody loves Justine. And even Frankenstein's mother loved her very dearly when she was still alive. She also talks about their youngest brother, gives an update on him, William. Apparently, they have a younger brother who's around 5 or 6 years old. So I guess he was born, like, right before their mom died. I don't know. So Frankenstein reads this letter, and he's absolutely touched, and he writes back, but they don't really say what he writes. And later, remember, Clearville's here to go to school, and so Frankenstein thinks, oh, okay, well, I have to introduce you to the professors. But this is like such a wall for him. This is a very mentally difficult thing for him because it has to remind him of his science and his studies and like what brought him to this point. So he's anxious and having like a mental breakdown as he takes him to go meet his professors. Every time he sees like a piece of scientific equipment, he has like a panic attack, and Clerval has to help him. And Clerval tries his best to like, you know, hide scientific instruments from him and stuff. So they meet Waldman.
Aw, wait, does he have a crush on him? Or is he just a really good buddy?
It's another 1800s crush. Yeah. Aww, yeah. Clerval.
Look
yeah,
how caring he friends. Is.
I know. It's great.
You know, after all of these, it kind of feels like they were much more okay with a myriad of partners and companions in the 1800s.
Yeah, it's funny. We were just having a conversation about this with, gosh, who was I talking to? Oh, yeah, I was just having a conversation about this with some of my family. That, like, did you ever watch, like, Lincoln, the movie Lincoln? Right?
No.
No? No. Oh. Like, it's worth watching because, like, of how it's interesting that take on, like, older society because he's constantly holding people's hands, right? Like, he'll be at a professional cabinet meeting and, like, reach across the table and hold the hand of the person he's talking to, right? Like, happens all the time.
Huh.
Let's bring that back.
Agreed.
Yeah, I want my bromance friend.
Yeah, time to find some dudes. Wait, out of context. Don't let your wife hear that.
Sarah, get out of the way. I'm going to go find some dudes. You're just not good enough. No, I'm sorry. I love you.
No, it's the multitude, you know. It's the, I won't use the word, but bros and instead of.
Not before, yeah.
Yeah, bros and, not before, exactly.
So they meet Waldman, his favorite professor, and he says, oh, this is your friend? Well, let me tell you about how brilliant Frankenstein is and how great he is at school, and this is really hard for Frankenstein to take. Because the more that people talk about his engagement in science, the more he is having panic attacks. So Henry notices this and does his best to change the subject. And Victor Frankenstein is very thankful.
Very frankful.
He's very frankful. So, yeah. They also meet the other professor, Krempe, who also has good things to say about Frankenstein, but it's much rougher and crude. And Clerval is here to study language, though. That's why he's here. He's going to study, like, Indian, Hindi, so that he can go there and, like, you know, he sees, this is the 1800s, and so he sees, like, a lot of opportunity, you know, for, like, colonizing places, so he's interested in language. And Frankenstein's like, yeah, sure, we'll study language, and he finds it to be a nice distraction, so he can distract his brain from all the terrible things in his mind. But eventually, Frankenstein plans to return to Geneva. He's gonna return, and then his trip is delayed due to weather or whatever. So he's waiting for a letter from his father from home, telling him when to come home. And the whole time he's hanging out there with Clerval studying language, and Clerval's company, his empathy, and his wonderful storytelling in the meantime make him feel much better. And that's the end of the chapter. Chapter 7. So this one starts with a letter from his father, whose name is apparently Alphonse. This is from Alphonse Frankenstein. And it says he knows, hey, look, my son, I know you've been waiting for a letter to come home, but first I have to tell you this bad news. William, their little 5-year-old brother, is dead. He's been murdered. Elizabeth and this father and their two brothers, William, the little kid, and Ernest, the 16-year-old, went for a walk. It was getting dark when they discovered that William and Ernest are missing, and they can't really find him. Ernest comes back, and he says, I don't know where William is. They search into the night, but they can't find him. And at 5 a.m. the next morning, after looking all night, Alphonse, the father, discovers William's body. And he's got finger marks on his neck. He's apparently been strangled. He returns back to his house with the little kid's body. Elizabeth sees the body. She looks closely at it and says, quote, oh God, I have murdered my darling child, end quote, and faints. Apparently, William had asked her, hey, can I wear this little locket or something? It's, quote, a very valuable miniature that she possessed of your mother, end quote. So apparently, from what I can tell from the book, it's like a locket with their mom's picture in it, and it's got like jewels on it and stuff. And he asks if he can wear it. Elizabeth says okay, and when they find his body, he's not wearing it anymore. So they assume that someone must have strangled him and killed him to take the necklace from him. And in this letter, Father mentions how, look, Elizabeth is completely consumed by grief. Frankenstein, you need to come home. And that's basically the letter. So Frankenstein reads this, and he's like crying. He gives the letter to Clerval. He reads it. He cries too. And Clerval's a great friend, though, and he does his best to comfort Frankenstein. And Frankenstein decides it's absolutely time. I've gotten the letter that says it's time to leave, and I need to go home. He's going to go back to Geneva. The journey takes him a long time, and he stops for long periods on the way. Quote, "Fear overcame me. I dared no advance, dreading a thousand nameless evils that made me tremble, although I was unable to define them." End quote. So apparently he's like really nervous about going home, but he can't quite put his finger on why.
Did therapists exist back then?
No, I'm pretty sure that the most famous like first behavioral therapist was Sigmund Freud, and I think that was what, late 1800s? I don't remember.
He needs one.
He definitely needs one.
So we can't really figure out why he's having a hard time going home. When he makes it to Geneva, finally, he decides before he goes to his house, first he's determined to visit the spot where William was murdered. He goes out into these Swiss hills, you know, it's all beautiful and stuff, but it's dark at night, it's storming, it's raining lightning, and as he makes it to this spot, he's kind of overcome by emotion. And he yells out loud. He yells, quote, "William, dear angel, this is thy funeral, this thy dirge." End quote. As he's out there in the storm, it's very dramatic. But when he yells this, he notices movement. And he turns to this little group of trees and stares at it where he saw this movement. And a lightning flash shows that there he is. There's his creation. And he's kind of stock still, stunned, staring at this thing. Quote, "He was the murderer. I could not doubt it. The mere presence of the idea was an irresistible proof of the fact," end quote. So he considers chasing him, but it's dark, it's rainy, and by the time the lightning flashes again, he realized the monster has moved an insane distance. And apparently there's like this huge rock wall. There's a lot of big sheer cliffs in these Swiss Alps. And this thing has already scaled most of the rock wall in a matter of seconds. Apparently it's insanely fast.
Okay, that makes no sense. How would the monster even be able to find his childhood home?
It's all a big coincidence. He just happened to know. He ran into the kid and was like, "This one. You smell like him." Also, he travels very fast because he's very tall. So he's got big steps.
He is very tall and he is very fast.
Yeah, he can use that tall guy beta on the rock wall too.
So Frankenstein at this point is starting to feel extremely guilty. He spends all night thinking about it, and in the morning he goes the rest of the way home and he's still thinking about it, and he considers immediately telling his family, "Hey, I spotted the thing that murdered my brother," but then he thinks that, one, they would think he was absolutely crazy. There's no way they would believe him if he said, "Hey, I spotted the murderer and it was this experiment of a human I brought back to life." And two, they would also realize that the whole thing was technically his fault, and he's not sure if he can mentally take that right now. Besides that, he thinks that, look, even if I did tell everyone and we all formed like a hunting party or something, this thing, I saw how fast it climbs. There's no way we're going to catch that thing. So he goes to his house. He goes home to his house, and the only person there is his brother, Ernest. And he's sad but happy to see him. And, you know, they talk a bit, and Ernest is talking about how, "Oh, it's terrible that you had to come now. I'm so glad you're home. But here's what's going on." Elizabeth blames herself. But he also says, "Oh, don't worry. The murderer has been caught." And Frankenstein wonders how that can be. He says, "Well, how can that happen?" He says out loud, "How can that be? He was so fast, and he was last night, he was free." And Ernest is like, "Well, I don't know what you're talking about. The murderer was our servant girl, Justine Moritz."
Because what? She wanted the jewelry.
Oh, well. Bringing out Sherlock Holmes now.
Thank you.
Frankenstein is absolutely stunned because he can't believe this. He knew Justine as well. And he says, that accusation is ridiculous. And you all know it. That's crazy. She's the sweetest sweetheart ever. There's no way. And Ernest says, no, don't worry. There's good evidence. The locket was discovered in the pockets of the clothes she was wearing. Point for Kalina.
Okay, yeah. So, but isn't she like a child? What about the strangle marks on the neck? Were they tiny or gigantic?
Good question. It actually doesn't say that in the book.
That's true, but he was like 5, so.
Yeah. So Victor refuses to believe that Justine is a murderer. He knows that she's innocent. Then his father comes in later. His father is also sad but happy to see him. You know, oh, that you came at this terrible time, but it's so good to see you. And Frankenstein says to his dad, Justine is innocent. You have to understand that. And his father says, well, she'll be tried today. So we'll see. And Frankenstein thinks to himself, oh, a fair trial will save Justine. It'll be okay. And then later, Elizabeth shows up. And she's aged a bit since last you saw her. So like now she's like more beautiful than ever. It's like the first thing that he says, right? And she also believes that Justine is innocent. She loved Justine like a sister. Like, they were the best of friends, and she liked her a lot, and she can't believe that Justine is not innocent. And Frankenstein assures her, don't worry, she's totally innocent. The trial will prove it. And they wait for the trial later that day, and that's the end of the chapter.
Oh, man, cliffhanger.
I have a question that doesn't pertain to the end of that chapter, but I did think of it mid-chapter when he was like, oh my god, how are we gonna catch this guy, like, you know, if he's giant and stuff. In this time period, what's the most advanced weapon they have?
I mean, there's guns.
At that point in time, they have like those single rifles, right? Like the single
shot. Yeah, I mean, technically the gun dates back to like the 1400s.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm so glad that wasn't common knowledge. Thank you, Crystal. Because I was like, oh, God, does it?
Yeah, a lot of medieval combat in like the 1500s was called, quote, pike and shot formations, because they had pikes and guns. They're really shitty guns, but they had guns. I'm kind of a history nerd, in case you didn't know.
Do you sometimes surprise yourself at how much of a history nerd you are?
Maybe. I don't know. I think like it doesn't hit home how much of a history nerd I am until I talk to people who aren't history nerds. And I'm like, oh, you don't know that? Okay.
That's why Taylor hangs out with me.
Yeah, I'm just going to go over to the corner now and be a nerd and listen to my history podcast.
Okay, so they could get a bunch of guns and like, you know, shoot them down.
Yeah, pike and shot formation.
Yeah, I heard that worked.
That's it for the first part of Frankenstein, everybody. We'll be back with the second part of the Stories of Sein Frankenstein next time. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you later.
Bye.
See you later.
We're not going to see them later. They'll hear us later.
Hear you later.
Hear you later.